Hello and welcome to day four. So we're going to be going over modules 10 and 11. We're going to do these two together just because they're relatively short. And then we'll also do 12 and 16 together on the next slide. But we're starting from module 10, and this is page 87. So this is called Following Safety and Emergency Procedures. It says simple precautions prevent serious injuries. Objectives for this module will include to discuss accident prevention, define first aid, list life-threatening emergencies, discuss the purpose of CPR, demonstrate abdominal thrust, discuss the use of protective devices, and describe alternatives to restraints, okay? So let's go over to page 88. Starts here with saying preventing accidents, right? So the best way to avoid an accident is to be alert to all safety hazards. So a lot of the interventions that we apply in healthcare is to keep our patients, as well as ourselves, from getting injured or, sustaining a fall or something that could deteriorate their health, right? Because that's not the goal, right? When you come into a healthcare facility, the goal is to get better, not that you get hurt there and, you know, everything goes downwards. So we're really, 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 really adamant on making sure that we are being very sensitive and aware to the environment that our patients are in, to their patient state. I mean, that's the whole concept. That's why we do vital signs, because we're constantly checking on the patient to make sure that they're responding well to medications and to care. And then, you know, on an external basis, making sure that their environment is also conducive for safety, right? So first chapter here says, be alert to safety hazards and take extra precautions to protect elderly and frail people from injury. Following are physical conditions related to aging and illness that put people at risk for accidents, right? So it lists a slew of things. Basically, poor eyesight, poor hearing, dementia. Some patients will have some form of paralysis or hemiplegia or something of the sort. Things like decreased muscle strength, decreased blood pressure. This can be related to age or some orthostatic hypotension or medications that your patients may be on. And then, of course, it says side effects of medications, right? So depending on what kind of pharmacological treatment they're on, some of the side effects could include, you know, loss of balance, drowsiness, confusion. So all of these things put together, we're seeing that our patients are just, they may not be as strong, and they are in an environment with, you know, the different medication managements and the structure of the rooms and things like that. They're in an environment where they can be more prone to falling or hurting themselves or, having some kind of centennial event, which is basically having some kind of bad event happening in the hospital that leads to deterioration, right? So we want to be very, very, very mindful and very alert with our patient. And a way to do that is making sure that we're alert to hazards, right? So safety awareness can prevent serious injuries. Be alert to the types of accidents that can occur. If something seems wrong, report it. It is better to be wrong than to wait until the problem is out of control, right? So these are some standard things that you're going to get kind of used to doing in the healthcare setting, and it'll just become second nature to you, but always remembering why we do them. So falls. Falls are probably one of the biggest and scariest things in a healthcare setting, especially for our elderly patient. Right. So when you're younger, maybe, you're 10, 15, 16, even a little bit older, you can sustain a fall. Maybe you break a bone. Maybe you don't. And you're probably going to be able to go about your life. A fall for a fragile or elderly patient can change the trajectory of their health. Right. There's some research there where patients' health just pretty much decline after a fall. So it is a big deal, particularly with our older patients. So it is huge that we're constantly vigilant to making sure that we are preventing falls. Right. When you're in the healthcare system, you'll see patients labeled as fall risk or fall precautions, right? That's pretty much everyone in the hospital or healthcare system. If you're under any type of care, if you're under any type of medical management, especially in a healthcare setting, I'm just going to assume that you're a fall risk, right? Even if you're strong and able in the real world, here there's a plethora of different things, right? You could be tired. You could have some infectious process that's making you a little fatigued, and then you have medications in your system. So that being said, just treat all of your patients like a fall precaution and just always be mindful of how can I prevent a fall. So big things that can be very, very huge, the main ones, you want to make sure that you're using side rails as necessary and if allowed, right? So you're, depending on the setting, there's a certain amount of side rails you can put up that's allowed before it's considered like a restraint. So like in the hospital setting where they have kind of the four-sided side rails, you can only put three up at a time. You can't have all four. That's considered some form of restraint. So you definitely want to know the setting that you're in. It's a little bit different in the nursing home setting, but knowing side rails are going to be huge, huge, huge. Like I would never want to go into a room where I know a patient has a huge fall risk and I see that one side roll is just, or one side is just completely open and they could easily roll off, or maybe they're a patient that's trying to get up a lot, they're a little confused. That side roll being open could be the difference between, you know, them falling and not. So side rolls are very, very important. Call signal may not seem like a huge fall prevention, but it is. A lot of times when patients are getting up and not utilizing assistance, it's usually because either they're impatient, you know, to waiting for someone to answer their call light, or they don't have their call light within reach and there's something they want to reach and go get or go use the bathroom, and they'll end up trying to make that journey on themselves, and then boom, you'll hear a fall. So just having a call light within that patient's reach so that they can give you a call, and then making sure that you answer those call lights promptly so that they trust that someone will call, is a huge way to minimize falls, right? Also, we want to make sure we're using proper lighting, and then very, very huge, make sure that you're removing obstacles to walking, right? So let's say you're in a patient's room and right in front of their bed, they have a chair, they have a towel on the ground, there's some trash in the corner, and the patient, you know, gets up and tries to walk, or you're walking with them and they trip on something, right? That's easily avoidable. We want to make sure we're always having a clear pathway, having good lighting so patients are able to see and maneuver the environment that they're ambulating in. Also, we want to make sure we're watching our patient's strength. So if you know you have a patient that's relatively weak, or maybe they're under some kind of medication that's making them weaker or dizzy or drowsy, or that drops their blood pressure, we're going to be extra super careful with them, right? Because even if, like I said, they're normally ambulatory and they're normally, you know, strong and able to move around, they just may be in a situation where they're weaker than usual, right? So we want to make sure that we're still keeping an eye on all of our patients, no matter how strong we think they are, because there's a plethora of things that can affect their mobility and their gait and their strength, right? And there's some more stuff to look on there, but those are usually the big ones. And then also making sure there are no spills on the ground. That also goes with making sure you have a suitable environment, as well as the non-grip or non-slip footwear. That's very, very important, especially if you're in the hospital setting, where oftentimes patients are not going to have their street clothes on, they're not going to have their you know, shoes from the outside world in, on in the bed, but you want to make sure that when you're transitioning them to get up, that they have those non-grips, those grippy non-slip socks, just because it prevents fall. It's huge for preventing fall. If you're in the assisted living setting or the nursing home setting, or even still in a hospital setting, and you're not utilizing those socks, then you want to make sure you're putting on some kind of stable form of shoes before they get up. A patient should pretty much never be walking barefoot. That's pretty much never acceptable. Number one, that's not sanitary. Number two, that's just a huge risk for a fall. They should always have some kind of footwear, preferably not slip, when they're ambulating. Going over to page 89. It talks a little bit about accidental poisoning and burns, electric shock, and preventing choking. You can kind of read through the poisoning and burns and shock. For the most part, these shouldn't be things that you run into too often. So we know just in regards to preventing burns, so it says preventing cigarette burns by enforcing smoking restrictions. All right, so hopefully your patients aren't smoking in the facility, so you really shouldn't run into a lot of these things. Main thing I can say in regards to making sure bath water is not too hot, so that's something in your control. If you're ever giving a bed bath, you want to make sure you're always putting, you're checking the water temperature before you're putting the water on the patient. Usually, you know, the water doesn't get too hot, but just always double checking, making sure we're not giving our patient some kind of burn just from trying to give them a bed bath. Electric shock, again, this isn't something that you should see too often, but the main thing is making sure that you're operating equipment according to instructions. If the patient has any type of medical equipment, make sure that It's within your scope to operate it. If you have any questions about it, or if you feel like something looks wrong or frailed, definitely let your nurse know. Now, preventing choking. This is important. So some residents are at risk of choking. Be alert to the possibility of choking, especially when residents are eating, right? So that big, flash red hot sign for when we want to be the most mindful of a patient choking, obviously, is when they're eating. So this is why we're always making sure that the residents are supervised during the meal times. What's very important is the angle of the bed. So you should never, never, ever, ever in this world, you shouldn't even be doing it for yourself. You should never be feeding a patient who is laying flat down, right? Even when it comes to maybe you're in their room and you're bringing them something to drink, like some apple juice. The minute you're introducing any type of fluid or solid into someone's mouth, you need to elevate their bed. They need to sit up, preferably 45 to 90 degrees. Again, we're never, ever, ever putting anything in anybody's mouth. There's a huge risk for choking and aspirating. We do not, again, we don't want to cause our patients any harm, okay? Making sure that patients are using dentures if needed, as well as cutting food into bite-sized pieces, right? So if a patient usually utilizes dentures, maybe they don't have proper dentation, so be able to chew food, which is very, very important. If they're not able to masticate appropriately, you're getting huge chunks of food that's going towards the throat, and they're at huge risk for choking. Also, whenever you're feeding, even if it's a patient with dentures or who has the appropriate dentition, we want to make sure we're cutting it up to appropriate sizes. Number one, so they aren't having to work so hard to try to move the food back down, but also so that by the time the food gets back there, there's a better chance that it's chewed up properly and won't become a choking hazard. Now, we'll talk about abdominal thrusts more so kind of in clinical and skills, as well as, maybe some CPR training. But the mainstay for choking, the main intervention is going to be an abdominal thrust. And again, like I said, we'll address it a little bit more in a few more pages when we talk about CPR and some life-saving interventions. Let's move over to page 90. So this is part two. It talks about promoting fire safety. So it says, be sure you know fire emergency procedures before disaster strikes. There's a very, very well-known acronym for how to respond if you were to see any type of fire, and it is called RACE. Do not forget it. That's RACE, right? So in case of emergency, it says stay calm, take immediate action to remove residents from danger. That's usually our primary goal. We want to remove our patients and ourselves from danger, as well as, minimize the risk of the fire spreading. So basically, it sets awareness of fire hazards as a first step in prevention. By removing any of these elements, a fire can be prevented, right? So flame or spark, of course, we know that's your typical fire. You can have oxygen-related fire. You can have fuel fire when there's any combustible material around. So let's talk about RACE, right? And again, if you smell smoke, do not open the door. The goal is to keep a fire contained, right? So if you smell smoke or a door feels hot, don't go looking in to see, hey, what's going on, right? You're going to immediately tell your supervisor, hey, I smell something, smells like smoke, smells funny. Let them investigate before you potentially help a fire growing get a lot worse. So the RACE acronym, we have RESCUE. So this is the first thing that you're going to be doing, right? Rescue any residents in immediate danger. A is to sound the alarm. A is for alarm. C is for contain the fire by closing doors and window. And then E is extinguish, right? So that's your RACE acronym. So remembering the first goal is, let's say we walk into a patient's room and there is a little trash fire, right? Like you see a little fire in the trash. The first thing you're going to do is you're going to take that resident in the room. Let's say they're sitting in the wheelchair. You're going to grab that wheelchair and you're going to wheel them out of the room, right? You're going to remove your patient from immediate danger. You're not going to address the fire first. You're going to remove your patient. Then you're going to go to your nearest fire alarm. You're going to hit that fire alarm. So this means you're activating protocol while you're trying to figure things out, right? You don't want to be in there figuring things out and no one is aware that you're in there fighting a fire by yourself, right? So you're going to ring the alarm. So you're going to contain the fire. So at this point, you're going to go out. At this point, you're looking for a fire extinguisher, or someone's bringing a fire extinguisher. But we want to close that door and try to contain the fire. There's different ways to contain trash fires. But for the most part, we want to make sure that we're keeping it from spreading. And then extinguish, this is where you actually get your fire extinguisher. And in a sweeping motion, you're going to try to extinguish the fire. But remember, your first goal is to remove patient and then set that alarm, contain the fire, then we're extinguishing last, okay? And page 91 just goes to talk about just kind of some different hazards that can contribute to a fire. So again, like faulty wiring. Smoking is a huge one. That's usually why you cannot smoke inside of a facility, especially next to oxygen, because you can have oxygen-related fires. Going over page 92, if there was ever fire that were to touch your body, a huge thing is to stop, drop, and roll. I'm sure you guys have heard of that before. This is very, very important. If your clothing ever catches on fire, you want to stop. You want to go to the ground, kind of decrease the amount of oxygen going to that fire, because oxygen exacerbates a fire. It kind of fuels it. So you want to go down and basically roll that fire off, right? And then definitely in regards to fire extinguishers, something that's very, very important to remember is the pass system, which is where you're going to pull, aim at the fire, you're going to squeeze, and then you're going to sweep. So you're always going to extinguish a fire in a sweeping motion. Part three, managing catastrophes. This isn't something that we heavily tested on, nor will you interact with most a lot, but mainly we want to make sure that we just know the emergency procedures, right? So this is something, whenever you're onboarding with any facility, they're going to talk to you about emergency procedures, emergency protocol, what to do on the risk of the need for evacuation, how that facility evacuates, if it's a multi-floor facility, how they evacuate from top to bottom, knowing the locations, all the exits, all the stairways, all of those are going to be pivotal. In the case of an earthquake or some kind of other major catastrophe, where are the safe zones? These are things that you're going to become familiar with depending on the facility, so you always want to know the emergency action plan for your facility. Going on to page 93, now we're going to talk about responding to emergencies. So, as you know, we have a CPR course that is offered here so that you can get way more in-depth knowledge of all of this. I'll just basically talk about basically why we do CPR and how to immediately respond, even if you will have to be CPR certified in a healthcare setting, but how to kind of immediately respond to danger, right? So it says top priority in an emergency is to protect yourself and the residents from the immediate danger. The first step is to assess the situation, right? Some principles of first aid is you want to make sure you're able to detect whenever a patient is in any type of distress, right? So you hear something called the ABCs in nursing, so that's airway, breathing, and circulation. If any of that is compromised, that's basically when we're considering something an emergency, right? So that first one, number one, says act quickly, giving priority to the most urgent conditions. Tend to life-threatening emergencies in priority order. So that number one is breathing, right? So that's airway. If you ever see airway compromised, if a patient is breathing very fast, looks like they're turning blue, complaining that they're having trouble breathing, we want to be very mindful of that and respond appropriately. Cardiac arrest, right? So that is circulation. This is basically the main reason why we do CPR, and we're going to do that basically by assessing and making sure that the patient is not responsive, and checking if we have a pulse. This is all the CPR protocol before we initiate things like CPR. Any severe bleeding that you see, the patient sustains a head injury, open wounds, the chest or abdomen, or any forms of shock. Again, you'll go into this more in depth whenever you get CPR certified. But what's huge here is being able to recognize someone that's in distress. A huge thing is any patient that's not responding to you. So decreased responsiveness or altered mental status. Let's say you went into a room earlier and you were talking with the patient and they were completely with it, right? So alert and oriented times four. They knew where they were. They knew what was going on. They knew the day, time, and situation. And now you go back in the room and patient now is kind of like stumbling on their speech, or you're asking them what their name is and they're not able to tell you. That's a change in mentation, and that's an altered mental state, right? Altered mental status. That is a huge, 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 huge red flag that there may be some kind of emergency process going on, right? So I don't know if you've ever interacted with someone with a stroke. Something like a mainstay for stroke is patients will start to kind of slur their speech, not really responding appropriately, kind of speaking in a word salad. That is an acute emergency, right? So that's letting you know there's something going on in the body that's rapidly either decreasing oxygen to the brain or decreasing oxygen to the heart or what have you. So in those protocols, we want to initiate some kind of rapid response, right? So for CPR, again, the main thing, and again, this is basic information. It's not a CPR course. That is completely different. CPR is just a very, very valuable life-saving skill. It basically works by assisting with circulation in the body whenever the heart is failing to do so for whatever reason, right? So, and we're doing and managing both circulation in the body and airway in the body through compressions and giving them breaths, right? So the compression, as you know, is going to be over the chest, and that is us pretty much manually pumping the heart. And then airway, we're opening the airway using the head tilt chin lift method, and you will be delivering breaths or giving breaths with a face mask, whatever method you have available to you. And you'll basically be alternating between the two. Compressions, opening up the airway, or the three, giving a breath and repeat and recycle until the patient is stabilized or you have another emergency personnel who's at the scene and can take over in a bigger way, right? So CPR alone is unlikely to restart the heart. The purpose of CPR is to restore partial flow, right? To keep oxygenation and circulation in the midst of an acute kind of myocardial infraction or some kind of ischemia that's occurring in the body. For the abdominal thrust procedure, so this is what we're talking about in regards to choking. So abdominal thrust, also famously known as a Heimlich maneuver, this is emergency first aid, right? So if someone were to give you that universal choking sign, they have their hand around their neck, not really responding or making choking sounds, you'd want to immediately run up to them and deliver abdominal thrust. And this is basically, main thing is if the person is conscious, you're going to stand behind them, put your arms around their armpits, wrap them around the person's waist. You want to make a fist with your hand. Place the thumb side against the victim's abdomen, just above the navel, below the ribs. Grasp your fist with the other hand, and then you want to do quick thrusts inwards and upwards, right? So you're going in and up. And the goal is to get the lungs to explode, whatever the obstruction is, whatever they swallowed that went down the wrong hole, right? You're basically repeating until you alleviate this. But again, you will get a deeper dive into all of that with your CPR course. Those are just some basics. Going over to part five, this is using protective devices, right? This is in regards to restraints. So management for a nurse aide, you should never be the one applying restraints. That is within the scope of a nurse. However, you are definitely there to manage, right, in regards to watching, looking at a person's circulation, if a person is reporting pain, if restraints become loose, those are all things you're going to communicate to your nurse ASAP, and this is usually an order that's going to be written out for the doctor. So in regards to restraints, these can be done for a plethora of reasons, right, and depends on the setting. So you may have a patient who has a restraint mainly because they're at risk of harm to themselves or maybe others. It could be an acute psychological event, or most of the times maybe you have a patient who is a bit altered or not really, you know, intellectually, developmentally appropriate at that time, and they may be reaching for their lines or drains, right? So let's say they have oxygen on and they just continuously, or IV. So they have IV in their arm that they really, really need, and out of just confusion, they keep reaching for that IV. You may get some kind of wrist restraint to keep them from removing the IV just because it's necessary for their care. And other times, like I said, it could be a psych emergency where the patient is at risk of harming someone or harming themselves, so you have to restrain them. Though it goes through thoroughly describing restraints, for the most part, applying restraints is going to be a nursing scope of practice. You just want to make sure, again, that you're looking at circulation. If a patient says, oh, my hand is turning blue, I can't feel my fingers, this restraint is too tight, that's something you want to go over and communicate to your nurse. So just so that they can go and adjust it. Or again, if you come in and you see that restraints are loose, that's not a good thing because there's a reason that they're on. So you want to go and talk to your nurse so that they can do what's appropriate. And then alternatives to restraints, right? So the goal is by the time that you are getting to any type of restraint, you have tried pretty much everything that you could to manage whatever it is that you're worried about, right? So whenever possible, you want to make sure that you consider activities that may reduce the need for restraints. And here are some suggestions. Companionship and supervision, that's usually a big one. A lot of times patients become restless or maybe are seeking attention or seeking for someone to come back into the room. Maybe it's just because they just need, you know, some companionship. They need someone to check in on them. So a lot of times if you're coming in, doing your rounding, checking in with your patients, you know, establishing that some type of rapport, it kind of decreases that restlessness and anxiety for to have them continuously squirming around the bed or trying to get up. Physical and mental activities, you know, keeping someone occupied as well. So just imagine if you had to sit in a room round the clock, having nothing to do, that can cause delirium or, you know, just overall restlessness. And also mattresses that are ordered for the floor to reduce injuries from falls, preventative programs to calm aggressive behavior. So in the case that you're having something psych related contributing to that patient needing restraints, we want to make sure that we're addressing their psych needs and finding ways to keep them calm. Sometimes just sitting with the patient or having a sitter for a patient in lieu of a restraint, you'll see that happening. So instead of, you know, tying them down to the bed, making sure that you're having someone there who's able to keep an eye on them and supervise them and can just let the nurse know if they're getting up or they need something or they're at risk of dislodging some kind of line. That's basically like a human monitor rather than a restraint. And in all things, make sure that you're following each resident's plan of care. The plan is based on the assessment of the resident. Talk to your supervisor if you have any questions or concerns about restraints or protective devices. So just reading the summary here, the resident's safety and well-being are the nurse assistant's top priorities. The best way to avoid emergencies is to use preventative measures. Emergencies happen. Learn the facility's emergency procedures and stay current with first aid and CPR training. In case of emergency, stay calm and respond quickly. Never use restraints unless you are directed by your supervisor. Limit the need for restraints by practicing alternatives to restraints. So that pretty much summarizes that chapter. Going over to page 98, make sure you do the review. Answer those 8 questions so that you can strengthen your knowledge in those topics. And I did say we're going to put those two together, so we're going to go through module 11 very quickly. So this one starts on page 99, and this is called Providing Good Nutrition. It says everybody needs a variety of foods for good health. Identify basic food groups. Explain the importance of good nutrition. Recognize conditions that affect eating habits. Discuss changes in behavior that may relate to improper nutrition. And explain how to prevent complications from dysphagia. So we'll talk a little bit about dysphagia. Understanding nutrition, a balanced diet is essential for health and body functioning. So here it just kind of goes through, you know, basic food groups, eating right. My plate is a very good resource to kind of look at general guide for maintaining a healthy diet. It just basically explains some nutrition stuff. So we all know that we need vegetables, fruits, grains, proteins, dairy, and oils, of course, in appropriate portions. So we're always making sure that our patients are getting the appropriate nutrition because that's going to help with quality of life, with health, and with healing, right? Let's go over to page 101. We're going to go on to that top left part of the page where it says following are examples of special diets. So you always want to make sure that you're familiar with what type of diet your patient is on. This is something that you should get in report or you should see in the patient's care plan. Some patients may be on a salt-restricted diet, maybe in regards to some kind of pathology or cardiac pathology. Some patients are on a soft, mechanically soft diet, a pureed diet, diabetic diet, clear liquids, full fluids, soft and bland. All of this is going to kind of depend on the patient, what they have going on, and what we're worried about, right? What's really, really important for you to know is you need to know what type of diet they're on, right? So if you have a patient who is on a full fluid diet, clear fluid diet, and you see some pancakes headed to their room, you want to stop and double check, hey, this is a patient that's on a clear, you know, clear liquid diet or a liquid diet. Let's make sure that we're sticking to or making sure that they're getting the appropriate diet. There's a reason that they're on their diet, that diet, right? They may be clearing out for a procedure, or they may be having severe diarrhea, so maybe just to, you know, manage their stomach, or they may not be able to chew foods and swallow them. So we want to make sure that, we're always paying attention to a patient's diet and making sure that they're getting whatever their special diet is. Also, we want to observe each resident's normal eating habits to determine whether nutritional needs are being met, right? So if a patient is getting a tray that they're constantly not finishing or not even wanting to touch at all, and this is being consistent over breakfast, lunch, dinner, or every single day you notice, yeah, they never eat their breakfast, make sure that, you know, they're getting something that they're able to eat, they're able to chew and process, or that they're interested in. That's also very important. And then following our physical and mental conditions that can affect eating habits, digestive problems, medications can alter appetite, loss of teeth, of course, and poorly fitted dentures make it hard to chew and eat, reduced sense of taste, swallowing difficulties, so one of those would be dysphagia, and inability to eat without assistance, as well as emotional upset or depression. All those things, as you know, can affect a patient's appetite and desire to eat or ability to eat, right? So we're going to go over to part two, where it says serving food. It says make mealtimes enjoyable for the residents. We want to make sure that we're assisting our dependent residents. So for the patients that are able to eat on their own, that's wonderful. You're going to have a plethora of patients who need your help, right? So we want to make sure that we're identifying those patients and making sure that we plan ourselves to be available and time our care appropriately so that we're there to help assist with feeding. So in regards to feeding, and again, this is a skill that you guys will go over in person, but just some steps in regards to getting ready. So it says, wait until you're ready to serve the food before you bring the tray into the room, following these guidelines to get ready. So you always want to make sure you are positioning the resident for comfort and safety, sitting upright again, 45 to 90 degree angles is the position anyone should be in when they're eating. You want to make sure their head is stabilized, and this is a patient that, of course, is able to hold their head steady so that they're not at risk of choking. Remind the residents to wear their dentures if that's needed. Assist as needed with washing hands and face. Be familiar with the resident's diet and any restrictions. Talked about some of those dietary restrictions. If the resident has been incontinent, change a person before serving food. Just think about it. Would you want them to be sitting in swelled depends, or sitting in feces while eating? No, that is inhumane, so making sure that they're clean and ready before they start to eat. And then you want to explain how to use special eating utensils and encourage residents to use adaptive self-feeding devices and understand progressive self-feeding programs and encourage self-feeding for residents who are able, right? So though our goal is always to encourage independence with our patients, we also need to identify if the patient needs help, they need help, right? But if, let's say you're dealing with a stroke patient and they're working with speech therapy and there's a specific type of spoon they're supposed to be using because they have some paralysis or weakness. If that's something that they're utilizing, you want to encourage them to utilize that as much as they can and then intervene when needed, right? In regards to serving meals, we want to follow the guidelines. So main things is we're going to wash our hands, keep hands away from face and mouth, be sure your clothing is clean, get your hair out of the way, protect any cuts with a waterproof bandage, check the resident's risk identification, making sure that you have the right patient, right diet. And you're going to do that by, please tell me your name. And it says the incorrect way to ask someone if you're verifying identity. You never want to allude to something. Because if I say, hey, are you Mr. or Mrs. Smith? they're confused, they can just say yes, right? We want to have them verbalize, hey, what is your name? If you have a patient who is maybe a bit altered, does not, maybe has some dementia, not able to say their name, or nonverbal, you can check wristbands, right? And we can check some other form to make sure that we have the right patients, making sure that you're reading their name and date of birth, making sure you're checking the diet card to make sure that they have the right diet, make sure the tray has correct food, beverages, silverware, napkins, cups, straws, provide special eating utensils, pick up eating utensils by the handles, keep fingers out of food. You want to make sure this is sanitary, and assist as needed with pouring drinks and cutting food. So main feeding guidelines, again, I can't stress this enough. Resident has to be in an upright position, 45 to 90 degrees. And we just want to make sure that this process is as sanitary as possible. So again, always making sure that you're clean and the patient is clean, right? And a huge thing is if you're feeding a patient, you want to make sure that you are at eye level with them. You don't want to hover over a patient and feed them. It's very intimidating. You want to pull up a chair, be at eye level with them, give them the opportunity to choose what they want to eat first instead of saying, oh, you're going to get this first, and kind of force feeding them as if they're a child. You would say, hey, what would you like? Would you like to start with mashed potatoes or meat, right? And then making sure you're cutting it up appropriately, sitting at eye level, and then feeding slowly, right? So you want to give the patient enough time to swallow the food, maybe doing sips of water or some kind of liquid in between to decrease the risk for choking. But make sure you're allowing them full time to chew and swallow before you're offering the next meal, right? And again, making sure you're encouraging liquids in the midst of the meal, just so we are avoiding any type of choking. It talks about kind of how to clean up after the meal and then offering snacks. I'm going to move on over to dysphagia. So dysphagia is difficulty swallowing. If you observe a resident who has difficulty swallowing, you want to make sure you report that to the supervisor, right? So things can change. Patients can deteriorate. A patient could have an order for a normal, regular diet. They could have all of their teeth, normal dentition. But you could observe them eating and see that they're either coughing with every bite, or they're, you know, throwing it up, or showing signs of choking, or kind of like pocketing the food on their cheeks, not wanting to swallow. Those are things you want to let the nurse know, because there could be some kind of acute change to where the patient is not able to swallow anymore. We want to make sure we're communicating that to the nurse so that they can communicate that to the doctor and then kind of get to the bottom of it and see why this patient is having trouble swallowing. And some foods are more difficult to swallow than others, obviously. A person with dysphagia may have difficulty swallowing foods that are pureed or sticky, such as mashed potatoes, thin liquids such as water, or dry food such as toast and crackers. So that's very, very important, right? So having trouble swallowing is not just about solid foods, depending on the type of dysphagia, and that is something that's going to be determined by another part of the care team. But depending on the certain part of the certain type of dysphagia, a patient may have trouble swallowing thin liquids, water, or things that are pureed or thickened, or solid foods, right? So we want to make sure we know what type of dysphagia they have and what precautions we need to take with them. As feeding a resident who has dysphagia requires both upright position, that's very, very important. Facing straight ahead, tilting the head back increases swallowing difficulty and could allow food to enter the lungs. So that's why we want to make sure we're upright and head is forward. We want to observe swallowing, watch for the Adam's apple rise and fall to make sure that a patient is swallowing. Be patient and do not rush the patient. Here's your summary for this chapter. Everyone requires food and fluids for health and survival. MyPlate is a general guide for maintaining a healthy diet. Some residents require special diets. Always check each resident's identification and diet card to ensure that you are serving the right meal to the right person. Make mealtimes enjoyable with pleasant conversation. Avoid rushing the resident and observe any swallowing difficulties or other problems, such as dysphagia. Be prepared to do the abdominal thrust procedure if necessary and report any eating problems to your supervisor. This is going to conclude the Providing Good Nutrition chapter. Make sure that you go over to page 104, answer those 8 questions. Make sure that you're reviewing, kind of testing your knowledge. And yes, main things you just want to focus on: adequate nutrition, adequate procedures when it comes to feeding patients, being mindful of how to prevent choking, and then to how to address choking or any type of emergency if you're in the face of it.